Very good. So this, if I'm not wrong, it's a Thursday morning?
Yes.
Oh, good. I should pay more attention to the days of the week, because I still remember just being a young monk in Thailand, you didn't worry about the days of the week. They're all the same. You knew when the full moon was hot, but other than that, you didn't really worry. Monday, Tuesday, Sunday, it's all the same. But then when I came to Australia, we're staying in this little house in North Perth, and there's one gentleman there, he was Nepalese, and he had an epileptic fit. And so we had to call the ambulance. And after the fit, he was just really out of it. When the ambulance came, they checked him up, and then they asked him some questions. And one of the first questions they asked him was, what day of the week was it? And I said, why did you ask that question? And they said, because that's one of the main questions. If they don't know what day of the week it is, we feel they've got some mental problems. And we take them to the ambulance, in the ambulance, to the hospital. And ever since that day, I always try to make sure I know what day of the week it is. Because sometimes people get the wrong end of the stick being a monastic or being a meditator. They don't quite understand what we do and why we do it, and they get the wrong information. Like in this one place in Sussex years and years and years ago, they decided to hold a meditation retreat there. It was a big house, and so they had lots of rooms where people could meditate, and they had a big old barn which they made into a sitting meditation hall. And it was only a weekend retreat. And then, obviously, during the times for walking meditation, the people would go outside to do the what they call the chankama, the walking meditation. The problem was that the owner of the house was a clinical psychiatrist. She was the head psychiatrist in the place, the local mental institution for people with very, very serious mental diseases. And everybody in her village knew that. So when one of those nosy neighbours opened the windows and saw those people walking really slowly, all dressed in white, she called the police. She did. And the policeman asked, professor or doctor, you know you're not allowed to bring the patients home with you. And I had to do some fast talking so that all those meditators didn't get taken away to the mental institute. Those are the old days. But some very funny stories. But nevertheless, today's talk, I've mentioned many things like the deep meditations and nimittas and the insights and the deeper insights. But what about the big insights? What are you doing all this for? So I thought today I would tell you, for those who haven't heard this before, when I became enlightened. Now don't go thinking, Ajahn Brahm told us he's not allowed to tell us anything. But I said I know all the loopholes, and I'll explain the loophole afterwards. You are shaking your head, Ping Pong, you know what's coming. So anyway, this was my fourth range retreat. So I'd already been meditating, you know, years before, and now I was in this very peaceful monastery in the northeast of Thailand, and there was nothing to do. As a monk, full range, you're senior enough to know the basics, but you're not senior enough to have any responsibility. So it was a wonderful time. And so we were doing our meditation, lots of time to do meditation. And then so one evening, you know, you get these evenings when the moon comes up, and then it's light in the evening. You don't need a flashlight, it's in the forest, but nevertheless you can see where you're going. So I notice sometimes your meditation starts to go really well. You get lots of energy, lots of clarity. It's easy to sit down to watch your breathing, and it's easy to do your walking meditation under the trees. and you were doing my, I was doing the walking meditation. I already had some very nice sitting meditation states, and doing the walking meditation. And sometimes you just get so focused, so still. And as you're doing the walking meditation, these insights started to come in. Some of you have also mentioned that, you know, that sometimes insights keep pouring in. You don't know from where, but they just happen. So there's amazing insights. It's like, you know, I hadn't seen that before. How could I miss that? And so all these great insights coming in. And every time you have a really nice insight and you, you know, see things in a totally different way, of course it gives you so much joy and energy. Wow, this is amazing. And even though it was late at night, maybe 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, still you had so much energy. You didn't really want to go to sleep. And you were enjoying just walking and seeing all these different ways of looking at the world. And then the big one came. Wow. Amazing different way of looking at the world. Amazing joy. Amazing bliss. And straight away I thought, the world has another arahat. A new enlightened being has just arrived. Oh, that was so lovely. You can imagine what it must be like to become enlightened. Nothing left to worry about in the whole world. Perfectly at peace and happy. So I carried on walking, and then I decided to go into the hall and do some sitting meditation. Like at 1 o'clock in the morning, you know, you'd always be a bit sleepy. This time the body was so straight, so full of energy, and the mind was so absolutely clear. And just watching a breath was easy as pie. You could see every part of the breath, and it was just so joyful. Having such a wonderful time, and it came to about 2 o'clock, and I thought, the bell goes at 3. I should have a little bit of a rest before we all the monks meet again. So I went to my hut, lay down. No way you can go to sleep. It's too much energy and joy. So about 2:30, I got up again and just I went to the hall to start meditation. You know, before anybody else had even arrived, before anyone rang the bell. And they were meditating just so straight and so beautifully. And when the chanting started, you know, usually that time of the morning, it would be about 3:30 when we started the chanting. That time we but not me. Yo, so Bhagavan, so much energy. It is so enjoyable. And then once we finished the chanting, a bit more meditation, not so easy. And then we got ready for our arms round. And when I went on the arms round, wow. It was like walking on air. And then when somebody gave, it's a very poor area, so we'd only usually get some rice, sticky rice. When they put some rice in my bowl, I wasn't allowed to talk to them, but instead I just blasted them with this incredible loving kindness. And I thought they didn't know how lucky they were. To be given a lump of rice to a newly formed arahant. Blast. Zap. And I was having a wonderful time. And then when we finished the last of the donors of some rice, then we went into the monastery, into the hall. And to my surprise, we'd only usually have like one pot of curry to go with the rice. It was a very simple monastery. And that pot would always contain the same thing. What they called in Thailand rotten fish curry. What it meant was that fish was collected from the paddy fields and they'd eat whatever they wanted and the rest of it they put in jars to pickle for the next year. So this rotten fish, which we'd eat every day, maybe with some banana shoots or whatever else they could find, really stank. And to give you an example of this, that one day in Wat Banana Chat, I was helping clean up around the kitchen, and then And I found one of the jars which they put the fish in. They don't add anything to preserve it. They just put it in and put a bit of plastic on the top and leave it. And I found one of these jars with some of the rotten fish in it. The plastic had broken. And so the flies had laid their eggs in it. And so it was all crawling with maggots. Yeah, it was disgusting. But you haven't heard of something more disgusting yet. I took it and I was going to throw it away. And then the head man of the village, Puyayoi, he saw me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Look, the plastic is broken. The flies have got in, they laid the maggots." He said, "You're going to throw that away? That's extra protein." And that's what we had the next morning. It stank, but you know, it's a subsistence economy. They could, whatever they could, they would eat. But anyway, this morning we had the usual pot of rotten fish curry. And next to it, there was another pot. That was incredibly rare. And that pot had this, I was a vegetarian before I was a monk, but you had to eat whatever was there, and there was often there was no vegetable food. The other pot was a pork curry. Edible. I don't know where it came from. Somebody from town must have bought it. But then I thought, no. Why did they bring it today? Those heavenly beings must be celebrating a new Elijah monk in the world. And I thought, I can have a nice meal today, something that won't cause me tummy ache. But then what we did, it was only a line, it's only a small monk, maybe half a dozen monks. And the head monk, you know, he had, when they offered the pots of curry, he had the first choice. So with a big ladle, I mean a really big ladle, he took one big ladle of the pork curry and put it in his bowl. You couldn't eat all of that. And then another one and another one. Three huge servings of the pork curry. And he was a local boy. He grew up with rotten fish curry, not like me. And I was sitting next to him. And I thought, oh, it doesn't matter, there's plenty left for me. What he did next. What he did next. He'd just taken his share of the pork curry and he lifted up the pot of pork curry and he poured it all into the rotten fish curry, stirred it all up and said, "It's all the same. It's all the same." And I thought, if it was all the same, why did you take yours first? You mix it up first and then that'd be... And I was really upset. The first decent meal of maybe a month and it all been wasted. And I was so upset and angry. But that was the end of the start of being upset. Because then I realised, enlightened beings don't get upset. They don't get angry. And I certainly was upset. And that made me double upset. You don't know really what depression and disappointment is until you think you're enlightened, you find you're not. That was really a bad day. And I tell that story, number one, because it's true, and number two, it just shows you just how you can deceive yourself and think you're enlightened when you ain't. And that's when just life comes along and does something like that. And you realize it's true, enlightened beings don't get upset, don't get angry. That means that, okay, I admit that I wasn't enlightened. And that's also why I can tell the story. So sometimes we want to get these insights, you know, to try and, you know, we hear that in Buddhism you can get enlightened. But do you know what enlightenment is? Imagine you're committing to a journey. You're getting on the bus, you're shaving off your hair, giving up all your worldly possessions, going to this destination called Nirvana. You don't really know what it might be like when you get there. Are you scared? Ah! Is this what Nibbana is? Can I go back? No, it's too late now. But anyway, I think you all have enough confidence. You read about the Buddha, or you see someone like an Ajahn Chah, and you realize, yeah, this is real, and it's a beautiful state. You know, to end all of your defilements, never to get angry ever again, never to want anything ever again. To be people take something from you, ah, so what? So these are those states where the closer you get to Nibbana, the more you appreciate it. To go back to a simile which I never really finished of the 1,000 petal lotus. One of the other things I like about that simile, it really shows you how the whole path works. You get into these wonderful jhanas, that's, you know, these inner petals, and they're gorgeous. The most beautiful, fragrant things you've ever experienced in your life. And the deeper you go into that lotus, the more delightful it is. And it only opens up, not through force or endurance, just to those two simple qualities of kindness and mindfulness. I should really add a third quality of patience, but the two types of patience you may have heard me saying before, it's very relevant at this stage of a meditation retreat. First of all, waiting for something to happen. There's only a couple of days left of this retreat. Are you still waiting for something to happen? If it doesn't happen, are you going to ask for your money back? You can. Look, I'm an honest monk. I'm fair. If nothing happens for the rest of this retreat, the last couple of days, if you want to ask for your money back, you can. You won't get it. Well, you can ask. That's fair, isn't it? So, 1,000 petal lotus. That, one of the things I'm going to add now before I forget, because I forgot last time. You know what that means? That you, sitting here, if you can just open yourself out more, go deeper inside, delightful breath there, it's right inside. It's not you have to go and get it from somewhere, or sort of go and build it and make it happen. It's just like kind of hidden inside, covered by all these other layers of petals. So are the jhanas. The jhanas are inside you right now. So when people say, I don't think I can get jhanas, you have jhanas in this simile. You just need to uncover them. Open out those outermost petals and see what's inside. It's a beautiful way of looking at it. And as they open up inside, what's inside the third jhana, it opens up and it's a fourth jhana. Beautiful contentment. And by that time, those petals are just so thin. They're just like gossamer. You can see almost through them to the next layers of petals. And they're very refined, very beautiful, out of this world, with their beauty and fragrance, give you so much joy. But then the other ones open up. And then you go into the heart of the 1,000 petal lotus. And you see, right in the middle of that 1,000 petal lotus. Many of you will know in the Vajrayana tradition, they often use that as a chant, Om Mani Padme Hum. You know what that means? Those words at the beginning, Om, it's like a namo, and Hum, it's just like sadhu. And the two words in the centre are the most important. It's like reverence to the Mani, which is the jewel, and Padme in the heart of the lotus. They're worshipping this jewel in the heart of the lotus that is you. And as you open yourself up after those last layers of petals, you can see the jewel in the heart of the lotus, at the centre of you. You know where that jewel is? There's nothing. There's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. Once upon a time, I gave the simile, and this was years ago, of the driverless bus. I think it was about 30 years ago now when I gave that simile. And that was way before, you know, Google and all these other high-tech companies over in California actually invented the driverless car and the driverless bus. Buddhist monks got there so much earlier, but we didn't take out a patent. It was a shame because we could have paid for so many nuns' monasteries. Now, high class, you wouldn't have to do any work. We'd have servants, maids, butlers for you all the time. Sorry, it's my fault. I should have patented the term driverless bus. But nevertheless, the simile of the driverless bus. Another insight simile. Life. Your life is like a bus journey. And sometimes when you're riding in your bus, you look through the window and there's such beautiful scenery. There's rolling green hills, lots of fish and chip shops. Whatever you like. And lovely trees and waterfalls and whatever you really like. And you look through that window and this is so delightful, pleasant scenery. And so you ask your bus driver, can you slow down or even park? What does your bus driver do? Puts his foot on the accelerator and accelerates out of there. And sometimes in your life, you go through the toxic waste dumps of life. They're smelly, they're stinky, they're just so obnoxious to look at, to smell or to hear. And what do? You tell your bus driver, let's get out of here quickly. And what does your bus driver do? Slams on the brakes and stops. Why is it the unpleasant, difficult, awful times of life last much longer than they should? Welcome to life. So what do? You come to a meditation retreat because you want to train your bus driver to get out of the difficult situations as soon as you possibly can and slow down when you're having a really good time. Are you enjoying Jhana Grove?
Yes.
Can we slow down the clocks? So 1 hour lasts, you know, for an hour and a half. And so you look at the clocks, wherever you're looking on, they go so slowly. So you can enjoy every moment of this retreat. Or you're having a difficult time, can we sometimes get some app or something to make all the clocks go fast? So it's the end of the retreat quickly. Can you do that? Sometimes that's what we hope. We try and come and do some meditation to get more happiness, make it last longer, so we can enjoy our life. We know that sometimes it's not going to be that easy. But if it is not that easy, you want to find out, how can I get out of this? I had an argument, I feel terrible. How can I let go of all that? All those bad experiences from the past, how can I let go of that trauma? And how can I find a beautiful partner in life, find a beautiful monastery, beautiful food, a wonderful job, where the boss is just so happy you've come in there that day and say, oh, wonderful, you don't have to do any work today, just sit there, it's just nice you being here, you don't have to do any work. And can we increase your pay? Can you find a boss like that? You know, sometimes there's one guy who came here and he said that in his next life, he wants to get reborn as a dog. He wants to be a dog in his next life. And I said, are you crazy? And he said, no, 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 look, use your logic. Dogs don't have to go to work. Dogs just sit around all day, sleeping, and if they're smart, they can get whatever food they like from their owners. I don't know what you feed your dog or cats, but sometimes, I know this one couple I used to go and visit, they would never feed their dog dog food. The dog would only have like roast chicken or beef or something. He was a very fussy dog and he got away with it all the time. He never did any work, he just slept in a corner somewhere. He had free health care, he didn't have to worry about that. And all he had to do, his only job was to take his owner for a walk twice a day. And he said, that's what I want to do in my life. I've been working too hard. A nice warm house, I can play in the garden, in the nice weather, and I just sleep. And then he said, that's why I want to be a dog in my next life. I worked enough. I don't want to go to school or university anymore, do more tests. I just want to lay down and be loved and have a nice, easy life. Would you like that? But then I said to him, in Australia, if you're born as a dog, you have to be sent to the vet to be de-sexed. When I said that, you can see, he started thinking, oh, okay, I won't become a dog then. He was a very sensuous man. Even dogs suffer. That's why one of my favourite stories I read somewhere, there was this woman, this is over in the United States somewhere, came home, you know, took all the shopping out of the car. She'd done her weekly shopping, and lots of bags. And so she didn't, she only just had enough fingers left to open the door with the key. And as she opened the door and kicked it open with her foot, a dog ran into her house. And she had nothing free to actually to stop it. So she put the bags of groceries down and then went looking for the dog. It entered her house and she saw the dog in one of the corners of the rooms, curled up, already fast asleep. And she looked at the dog, it was like a Labrador, really clean, had a collar on its neck, and you know, it was very benign. And she liked dogs, she took pity on it. Okay, you can sleep there if you want, you're clean, you're doing no harm. And so then she emptied the rest of her car and just put all the groceries away. And then after about an hour, the dog got up, had a very little bark, and then so she opened the door and the dog went out. And he came back the next day. And got in the corner, slept there for about an hour and a half. And after an hour and a half, the little dog, woof. And then I let her out, let the dog out. The dog did that for about 4 or 5 days. And she told her husband, and the husband said, why does that dog come into our house? And so the husband had this really brilliant idea. He wrote a note on a piece of paper. So this dog comes to our house every afternoon, goes into a corner and has a sleep for about an hour and a half. We don't mind, it's a lovely dog, it's clean, it's well behaved, it's welcome to come into our house. But we don't know where it's from, and we don't know why it comes into our house. And so they wrote that note, they signed it, it was like a message. And they tucked it under the dog's collar. When the dog sort of woke up, they let him out, or her out, don't know which gender, and then the dog went away, and the next day it came, they noticed there was another note under the collar, a reply. And the reply read something like, this is my dog, it lives a couple of blocks away, and it comes to your house, because in my house, you know, we've got the wife, my mother-in-law, about 4 or 5 kids. It's so noisy in my house. And those little kids, they're always like playing with the dog. I reckon the dog comes to your house for some peace and quiet. Can I come too? Said Asmund. And that's a wonderful story about a dog's real life. If they get just a couple or one person, they have a nice easy life. They have kids and they're playing around and jumping around and having lots of noise. Oh, it was a terrible life. But anyway, where did I start this from? I don't know. So, the bus. Yeah, the bus, yes. So, there's always somebody who can help me. So, in the bus, you go through beautiful territory and you want it to slow down and it speeds up. Go terrible territory and it parks. So you want to teach this bus driver, you know, about life and how to drive a car properly. But to be able to teach that bus driver, you've got to locate the bus driver, first of all. So eventually, you get up from your seat and you walk to the front of the bus to find the bus driver's seat and tell the bus driver with kindness how to drive the bus. And then when you get to the bus driver's seat, you get a big shock. You find the bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. It's a driverless bus. The thing you think of as choice and will, nothing there. You've got to get up and find a bus driver's seat first of all, and the bus driver's seat can be seen in the second jhana. That's where you find there's no one there. No one there. So what happens next? You get back and sit on your seat and you stop complaining. There's no one to complain to. You start getting upset at yourself or what you did or what you said or what you didn't do or didn't say. There's no one to complain to. In the future, there's no need for any desire. There's no one to sort of ask for anything. There's no bus driver there, so how can you tell the bus driver to go somewhere you like? When the bus driver's seat is empty and you really see that, you find that desire and ill will, complaint, no longer can happen. There's no one driving your bus. So that's what you see deep inside the lotus. Emptiness. That's the jewel. But that's just the doer. The choice. The will. I should say more about that because, you know, I was always fascinated. You know, why do I do things? Why did I become a monk? Many people ask me that question. You know, why did you come here for this retreat? I will tell you the answer. You didn't have a choice. You had to come here. That's why you're here. That's my proof. You can think about things, but it's weird that I always thought I was in control. That I could choose what I wanted to do. And you think that too. If that was true, there'd be no money to be made in advertising. Advertising is a weird thing. They always say that for every dollar spent in advertising, the firm makes $3 in profit. That's how profitable it is. And if you ever see any of the advertisements, well, in my day anyway, they were absolutely stupid. It was like a joke, it was like a comedy 1 minute. And when I saw them, I thought, no one would believe in that. And one of the advertisements I remembered when I was young, I was a student, and a student looking for a partner in life, at least a girlfriend, and so I saw this advertisement for St. Bruno Tobacco. I still remember it. And it was just an ordinary looking guy, about my age at the time, an ordinary looking guy walking down the street, and no one was paying him any attention, and he got out like a pipe, not cigarettes, but like a pipe, because in those days, if you went to university, that was really cool to have a pipe. Einstein had a pipe. It was a sign that you were an intellectual. So anyway, this guy took out a pipe and put some Bruno tobacco in and lit it. It was an advertisement, okay? And he was walking down the road, and then there was incredibly gorgeous, like a supermodel lady working in the newsagents. In real life, I never saw anyone like that working in a newsagent. But anyway, it's an advertisement on TV. So she jumped over the counter and followed him, waiting for his first command, which she would follow automatically. She was enchanted with the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco. And then he passed a greengrocer's shop. And this lady there sorting out the oranges and the bananas, a beautiful, dark-headed woman. And she was enamored. And she joined the beautiful first lady following him, waiting to please him in whatever way he wanted. Because some Bruno tobacco, they said, and this was actually, quite a few other ladies were following him by the end of the advertisement. And they were all absolutely gorgeous. And the motto was, the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco was irresistible to the opposite gender. And that was it. Absolutely inane. Absolutely just stupid. Absolutely, who would believe in that? Of course not. And I went, I lit it up and walked down one of the streets in Cambridge. No one jumped over any counters. And the only person following or being following me was a dog. But what I was really surprised was that I bought into that. Why? Because somehow or other, it got under my protective radar. I thought it was just funny, but it actually got underneath. And I kind of believed it. Why in politics do they put millions, sometimes billions of dollars into advertising to get you to vote for stupid people? That's called democracy. And the killer argument for the nature of will was, again, in one of those psychic research societies. One of the experiments they did there were, I attended. Because every year, they get in a hypnotist. First of all, you know, seeing a hypnotist who was, you know, was a good hypnotist, but has also had a sense of humour, you get so many laughter at that. It was like entertainment, but it was also so much education as well into the nature of the human mind through hypnosis. And, you know, we were all just, you know, willing to give it a go. They tried to hypnotise me, but I was just too resistant. And so there was always one student would be easily hypnotized. And I put him in this trance, and it was fascinating to see. And make him do all sorts of silly things. But then, the most important part of this experiment, they told this student that they were going to take him out of hypnosis soon. Once he's out of hypnosis, he won't remember anything which happened during the hypnotic trance, except that when the hypnotist touches his right earlobe, this student, no matter what is happening, will stand up and start singing the British National Anthem in a loud voice. Now, even at Cambridge, we're all rebellious. We would never do that. But we were all waiting. He took him out of hypnosis. And then this hypnotist was really good. He would get his finger close to the ear and then just push it away again. He was like playing, was getting us excited. But then eventually the hypnotist touched his right earlobe. And then this young student stood up and started singing in a really loud voice, "God save the Queen." And it was, we were all hysterical. We were laughing our heads off. We couldn't believe just how this intelligent young man, in the middle of, you know, most inappropriate time, would start singing the British national anthem from beginning to end. We were howling with laughter. And he finished. He didn't allow the laughter of all the students to stop him. And then the hypnotist very calmly asked him, "Why did you sing the British national anthem at that time?" And then this student, who was highly intelligent, the student, he gave an explanation, a reason. And that's when I got the chills down my back. Because to that student, it was very obvious to us all, he made up the reason, but he sang that anthem because the hypnotist had told him to. He never knew that. But the student had sung that anthem. He was fully convinced he'd freely chosen to do it. And I got the chills, because how many of the times when I thought I freely chose to do something, how many times did I really make that decision? And how many times was I not hypnotized but conditioned to do that? And I know that there's the power of that conditioning. It's one of the reasons why I don't mind spending a lot of time and effort teaching you. I am brainwashing you. I admit that. In a good way. That's what the Buddha did. As I mentioned, the Buddha Kassapa did that to our Buddha. And the Buddha did that to his disciples, people like Ananda and Sariputta. And they did that to their disciples. And eventually they did that to Ajahn Chah's teacher, was Ajahn Mun. And Ajahn Chah did that to me. And now I'm doing that to you. I freely admit that. But it's good, because that's how you learn how to let go. Paratagosa, the words of another. One of the most important things to become, to see the Dhamma, to become a stream winner. To see non-self. There's no doer in there. It's a process, it's conditioned. But as you go deeper into that lotus, deep into meditation, you see, even a second, what I used to call the citadels of this idea of a self, the knower, your mind. After a while, you see, even that is conditioned. It's not an absolute eternal entity. After a while, you see, that can stop. There's nothing left. The jewel in the heart of the lotus is empty. Nothing there. Do you understand? And sometimes, why do people find that hard to accept? It's that attachment. The attachment to this sense of self. Wanting to do things, wanting to be the doer, wanting to be the knower. And they give that a huge identity. And after a while, how much do you know? Sometimes people get very proud. They've got degrees. Degrees of insanity. That's why. It was Venerable Jyotika's brother. He was the one, he was given a PhD for something. And he said, well, the meaning, I never knew what the meaning of PhD was. Do you know what the meaning of PhD? It means permanent head damage. That's what he said. If there's any doctors here, I do apologize. No, I don't really apologize. I'll be insincere. Insincere. One of those sayings which I will give you is, never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. It's a lovely saying, because sometimes you've got a PhD You're an expert. You're an authority. Have you ever noticed that some PhDs can be so stubborn, stopping progress? They can't see, you know, what an ordinary person can see, because they've spent so much time and effort learning, and their learning is acknowledged. They've got a certificate for it. It's one of the reasons why when we talk about enlightenment, we don't do certificates. I know this one place did in Colombo. Quite a few years ago now. They would have not just 9-day retreats, I think it was about 2-month retreats. They do a lot of meditation, a lot of study, a lot of teaching. So they didn't just do the practice, they did the theory as well. And so anyway, there was this elderly Sri Lankan woman, you know, from up in central Sri Lanka, came to see her children who were studying in, not studying, they'd graduated, and now they had little businesses in Colombo. And the children, they're very happy to see their mum. Their mum sacrificed so much for them so they could actually get a good education and get successful businesses. But they had to do their work themselves, and how can they spend time with their mum? So they got a nice plan so they can really look after their mother, but without having to spend too much time with her. They said they knew she was a very devout Buddhist, was always going to the temple. They said, there's this retreat center close by. And in this retreat center, there's 2 months, and you can do lots of meditation, lots of learning. We decided we'll sponsor you. You don't have to pay anything. So we'll sponsor you. We've got you a place already in the next retreat. Really, all they were doing is trying to get rid of her. But in a nice way. So she went to that retreat center and she practiced meditation. She learned the Dhamma. And now she'd been a Buddhist all her life, so she was very experienced. And so she was doing really well, getting some nice meditation, some nice insights, deep understandings of Buddhism. And then towards the end of the retreat, they gave her some interviews and tests. And then, when the day of the final day of the retreat came, they went up to her and said, "Grandma, we got some really good news. You know, our experts have, you know, looked at your meditation, listened to how you described it. We've tested you on some of the Dhamma. And we're very glad to give you the news. We've unanimously decided you are a stream winner, a soul one. First stage of enlightenment. Congratulations." And they gave her a little certificate, her name on there. And this particular retreat center just guarantees or qualifies you as an authentic, a real stream winner. And they signed their names, and her name was on the certificate as well. Now you might get a PhD or an MA or some other certificate, you know, like a certificate which allows you to be a doctor or a counselor or something. But this, a certificate for enlightenment, I mean, that's pretty huge. So when they handed it to her, they were so surprised that she started getting really angry at them. "What's wrong, Grandma? It's a stream winner. It's an amazing thing. Like, half the people in Sri Lanka will never go to teach there. They always want to become stream winners. And what's wrong about this?" And she looked at them with a type of just piercing anger which only these elderly women can actually give. Really scary. She said to these people, "You don't remember me, do you?" I said, "No. I was here about 2 years ago. Last time you gave me a non-returner certificate. You've demoted me. That's why I'm angry." They didn't remember her. You can't go backwards. So because of that, the word got around, and that was the end of that retreat center. We don't give certificates. You know why? because there's nowhere to pin them on. The real stages of enlightenment is nothing you boast about, but the more you disappear, there's less of you, not more of you. So if any of you get any wonderful insights, and you ask, is that stream meaning Ajahn Brahm? Isn't it? Please, please, please. And I say, there's no place to pin a medal on. Sorry. It's the stages of disappearing. Where there's less of you, where there's less of you, there's less of a target for suffering. There's more peace, more happiness. You're not weighed down by anything anymore. Pain, happiness, it's just Vedana. Success, failure, that doesn't mean anything. Praise and blame, even the Buddha received a lot of blame and a lot of praise. And he said, there's not one human being in this world who has only praise and not blame. As human beings, it's not what you do, it's the defilements of other people create that criticism. So after a while, you have less and less which you own. You become possessionless. You let go of things. You don't attach to anything. Which means that the whole ideas of attainments disappear. And you understand that the path of freedom is a path of having less and less and less. That means you're empty inside. Nothing left. So the path of meditation, if somebody asks you, are you enlightened? And you say, who? If they ask you, is Venerable Jhenti enlightened? Who is Venerable Jhenti? Is it your body enlightened? Your Vedana is enlightened? Your Sanya is enlightened? Your Sankara is enlightened? One of your six consciousnesses is enlightened? When you put it like that, it just shows how meaningless it is to think of these things as attainments. Which of your six senses is enlightened? When you analyze it, it sees it for what it truly is. The problem is just thinking you're enlightened. That shows you you're not. That makes sense? Okay, so that's a little talk today about enlightened. All you need to do is get in the middle of the lotus and find out there's nothing there. Pretty easy. Okay. Sadhu. 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 Very good.